C3.ai.
For that. Can you just do? Welcome to True Talk on WMNF 88.5 with Ahmed and Samar. On today's program, we're going to be speaking about what's happening in Kashmir, as well as the Turkey's incursion into northeast Syria. We'll have a special guest to talk about Kashmir, and then later we'll talk about what's happening between Turkey and Syria and the Kurds. All this and your phone calls on True Talk on WMNF 88.5. We'll be right back. To True Talk on WMNF 88.5 with Ahmed and Samar. Samar, good to be here with you. On today's program, we're going to be speaking about what's happening in Kashmir. Many Americans, we tell them about Kashmir, they think sweaters. but Kashmir is actually a place, one of the longest running disputes in modern times between India and Pakistan and the Kashmiri people who want independence. And there's been some disturbing events that are happening there. But also, later on in the program, we'll be also speaking about what's happening between Turkey and in northeast Syria and the Kurds. Everybody's talking about our allies, the Kurds. What's the story behind that? How do you feel about it? I think we may have some disagreements, but don't get into that yet.
No,
and
I'm not gonna say
hi
anything.
To all our...
we want to thank them, Ahmed.
Well, no, I also want to just say hi to people watching us on Facebook.
Yeah, we have lots of people.
But I think there's like five.
No, I just joined.
Oh, you joined? Oh,
so
if you
six.
Join, you have... Oh, you joined?
Six and probe.
But why don't you share with your 100,000 followers on Twitter?
110,000.
By the way, this Saturday, I'm helping organize an event for Palestine with the famous Goodwill Ambassador and recording artist Mohammed Assef, Palestinian. American.
The music still playing.
It was still Kashmir music. That was music from Kashmir, by the way. Because we're going to talk about Kashmir. Janan Saw?
Sayyida. Sayyid. Mehmeti Sayyid, something like that.
Janan Saw Sani by Mehmet Sayyid.
Yeah, Mehmet Sayyid is the female singer.
Oh, Mehmet Sayyid?
Mehmet.
Like in Turkey, Mehmet is a... her name is Mehmet.
Mehmet, okay.
Because Mehmet is like in Turkey, or in Turkish is like Muhammad, which is like a man's name. But Mehmet, yeah, that's a female name. Yeah, that was a song by Mehmet Sayyid because of Kashmir. But speaking of songs, this Saturday in Orlando... We're having this event for Palestine with Mohammed Assef. He won something called the Arab Idol It's like it was
famous in the U.S.
Franchise of the American Idol show. So they actually had it there, and when he won, he made big news. So he's coming here Saturday. I think there are a few tickets left. You can go to irusa.org/promise if you need tickets. But about Kashmir, before we speak to our guests.
When you say for Palestine, what do you mean?
Humanitarian aid for the Palestinian people. There are some projects there for late women, single moms, for children. They have programs where they actually give a startup fund for women with children to create their own business. Mm-hmm. There are food programs sponsoring orphans. There are a lot of orphans there, so you can sponsor, like a person can sponsor a child there for their education and things for the whole year round. So that type of, I guess you have to clarify, because people think, Palestine is political.
For Palestine, what does
this is strictly humanitarian aid. Of course, it's in a U.S. organization, so there's so many restrictions of they're, heavily monitored and regulated, mm-hmm. and they have to do everything, following the law. And of course, that means very limited, even limited humanitarian aid, because there's some humanitarian aid, for example, like I remember during, at the time of the Gaza siege, which continues today, but at different portions, certain type of foods are not allowed in.
Mm-hmm.
And even after the Gaza invasion, they would not allow cement in, because you needed to rebuild after what happened there. But let's not get into that right now. I want to, before we talk about Kashmir, the Washington Post had a good fact checker. So I'm going to play parts of that while we bring our guest on. Okay.
Okay.
Kashmir state police officials have said the region is calm and returning to normal.
इस नई व्यवस्था के तहत हम सब मिलकर आतंकवाद, अलगाववाद से जम्मू कश्मीर को मुक्त कराएंगे.
The valley has remained largely peaceful over the last 1 week.
But video and eyewitness accounts suggest a different story. Understand what's happening in Kashmir, you have to understand the history of the long disputed territory. 72 years ago, the Indian subcontinent, which was previously under British rule, split into two separate independent states, Pakistan, which has a Muslim majority, and India, which has a Hindu majority. Jammu and Kashmir, which is on the border of India and Pakistan, initially chose to remain independent, but the Hindu prince who ruled the region later acceded to India. That move led to Article 370 of the Indian Constitution, which granted a special status of autonomy to the state. And the Indian government's decision to overturn it undoes nearly 7 decades of history. It removed Kashmir's semi-autonomous status, which gave it the power to make its own laws and prevented non-residents from buying property in the region. The government also stripped Kashmir of its statehood, turning it into a, quote, union territory. Both Pakistan and India still claim control of the region.
So it has been a big flashpoint between the two nuclear armed neighbors, which have been rivals since for the past 70 years.
Kashmir is a Muslim-majority state in India, and it's still a touchpoint in the predominantly Hindu country. Modi leads the Hindu Nationalist Party, the Bharatiya Janata Party, or the BJP, which won a landslide election during which Modi campaigned on the promise of revoking Article 370.
Its actual implementation came as a surprise to everyone in the country, and especially to Kashmir, because there was no sort of preceding dialogue or notice given to it. It happened all of a sudden.
In anticipation of the backlash to the decision, the Indian government shut down all forms of communication in Kashmir, including the internet, cable TV, and landlines. Thousands of security forces patrol the streets at checkpoints, public meetings of more than 4 people are banned, and schools and colleges remain closed. Many high-profile political leaders in Kashmir continue to be held under detention.
But there have been sporadic protests in the valley, but the government has tried to ensure that no large-scale protests or incidents of violence get reported.
Misinformation, including old video, has been widely shared during the aftermath of the announcement to revoke Article 370. However, the argument of old or fake footage has also been used to decry real protests as fake.
From what we found when we traveled there, there was a sense of anger and resentment against India's decision and the way it was implemented. And I think that's a crucial point as well, that people felt cheated and betrayed, that India, after making promises for all these years, suddenly sort of unilaterally decided to revoke something without even consultation with the people.
इसका प्रोटेस्ट इसलिए है जो इन्होंने दफा 370 की कोशिश तोड़ने की कोशिश की है उसके वजह से हम सारे लोग बच्चे बूढ़े मां बहनें सब निकले हैं रोड पे.
A section of the Indian national press and of course the government has tried to sort of push back on this and say that there are also people that are happy and that, you know, things are easing out, but I think what we found there was definitely that was not the case.
The Indian government has continued to change its story regarding a protest that occurred in Kashmir on August 9th. First, they denied a large-scale protest took place in Srinagar. Here's what video from the day shows. Fact-checkers in India geolocated the protest to this mosque in Srinagar. Signs referring to Article 370 verify these protests were in response to the recent decision and not old video that had resurfaced. The Indian government walked back its statement and acknowledged the unrest, but Kashmir state police officials denied any, quote, firing took place. Video published by the BBC has audio of firing and tear gas as protesters disperse. Officials later acknowledged pellets were fired and caused injuries. Their justification was that firing referred to live bullets, not pellets. More protests erupted on August 16th after Friday prayers and continued into the following weekend. In response to allegations that the protests were fake or using old footage, protesters started writing the date on their signs to prove that these protests were in fact happening. Photos and videos from the ground are hard to come by given the harsh crackdown on communication channels. While India eased restrictions on landlines in Kashmir after 2 weeks, authorities have refused to say when internet access and mobile services will be restored. The existing visual evidence points to irrefutable proof of discontent over the move to revoke Article 370, a reality the Indian government has tried to deny.
Welcome back to True Talk on WMNF 88.5, and that was a short fact check, kind of background on the issue in Kashmir by the Washington Post. Now joining us on the phone is Hafsa Khanjawal. She is the assistant professor of South Asian history at Lafayette College. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Hafsa, can you just tell us, for our listeners who are not familiar with this issue, when did this conflict start in Kashmir?
So officially, the Indian occupation of Kashmir began in 1947. This is when the Indian subcontinent was being partitioned, and Kashmir was one of the princely states. It had a Muslim majority, but the ruler at the time was Hindu, and he himself did not necessarily want to go to either state. So under partition, the Muslim majority states would have gone to Pakistan and the Hindu majority states would have gone to India. He kind of wanted to maintain Kashmir as an independent space. But after a series of things that happened, including a rebellion against his rule within the Jammu and Kashmir state and an army of tribesmen coming in from Pakistan who wanted to liberate Kashmir Muslims, he decided to accede to India. But that accession was never final. India and Pakistan went to war over Kashmir, and the future of the region was supposed to be decided by a UN plebiscite. And to this day, that plebiscite has never taken place. And that is basically the crux of the reason why this conflict has gone on for so long, is that the Kashmiri people have not ever been able to have their right to self-determination.
So the Kashmiri people, the demographics there, the majority are what?
The majority are Muslim, especially in the Kashmir Valley. In the regions called Ladakh and Jammu, there's significant Muslim populations, but also Hindu and Buddhist populations, and Sikhs as well. So it's diverse in terms of its religious demographics, but the majority of the entire state is Muslim.
Tell us about the recent crackdown or the more recent conflict and that was triggered by something, you know, the Indian government revoking Article 370. What is Article 370 and what did it mean for them to revoke that?
So So Article 370 was a part of the Indian Constitution. And basically when Kashmir acceded to India, India installed a series of client regimes of Kashmiris in the state who would be for that accession. And they would try to suppress any pro-Pakistan or pro-independent sentiments in the region. And these client regimes basically agreed that they would do so as long as India gave Kashmir some level of autonomy. So that autonomy was what Article 370 represented. It basically meant that India only had control over the region's foreign affairs, communications, and defense, and everything else would be controlled by the Jammu and Kashmir state, including that the name of the leader of the state would be called a prime minister. It would have its own constitution, its own flag, its own laws. Over time, since 1947, India has significantly eroded Article 370. So for most Kashmiris, it was just kind of symbolic in form. India controls pretty much every aspect of Kashmiri legal and constitutional life. But there was one part of the article that was really important that was under a provision called Article 35A, which basically stated that only Kashmiri state subjects could buy and sell property in Kashmir. And now, with that also being gone, the fear is that Indians would now be able to buy property in Kashmir and drive out the local population. So there is a fear of an actual settler colonial project, similar to what's happening in the Palestinian territories, and an eventual ethnic cleansing that can only happen when you actually drive out the local population and ethnically cleanse them. So when this happened on August 5th, the Hindu nationalist government at the moment that's run by Narendra Modi, the BJP, his party, has always wanted to completely integrate Kashmir into India. They never agreed with Article 370. They never agreed that Kashmir should be given this kind of special status. And that is what Modi ran, partly what he ran his electoral campaign on, was this abrogation. So he knew that it would have a lot of support amongst the Indian masses. And I think it was a way for them to really consolidate their base as he goes on to carry on even further authoritarian policies throughout India.
If you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF. We're speaking to Hafsa Khanjawal, a assistant professor of South Asian history at Lafayette College, and we're talking about what's happening in Kashmir. These client regimes that have been installed in Kashmir, what does that mean, and whose side are they on?
So these are families that basically decided to serve as collaborators, essentially, with the Indian state. And they are for India, as in they believe that Kashmir should be a part of India. But for the most part, they've always agreed that Article 370 is important. They hold on to Article 370, which is why when this most recent escalation happened on August 5th, one of the first things that the Indian government also did is not just arrested the pro-freedom or anti-India leadership in Kashmir, who, by the way, are almost always under house arrest as it is, but they also arrested the pro-India leaders, so their own people that they had kind of put into the state, because they wanted to make sure that no one in Kashmir would have any influence to mobilize against this revocation. So they still remain under house arrest, even these pro-Indian leaders.
Now, all this was happening at the same time that Modi, the Prime Minister of India, was coming to the United States to have this huge, massive rally in Texas called Howdy Modi, where he was celebrated and lauded by so many people here in the United States.
Yeah, exactly. He spoke to a crowd of about 50,000, mostly Indian Americans. Trump joined him in Texas, in Houston. And they, of course, kind of cheered on what was happening in Kashmir, these ghastly human rights abuses that we're hearing about. There's significant support within the Indian American community in the U.S. for the Hindu Nationalist Project, and a lot of them are huge supporters of the BJP and the RSS. And this is a really troubling turn. Modi also spoke at the United Nations General Assembly. But it's important to also know that in both cities, in Houston and in New York, there were huge protests against him and for Kashmir and for Kashmiri freedom. About 20,000 people in Houston and 20,000 people in New York. There's a other troubling things that happened during his visit. The Gates Foundation gave him an award at its goalkeepers event where, you know, they honored his government for building toilets across India. And sure, he's building toilets, but his government is also responsible for all of these human rights abuses, not just in Kashmir, but also in other parts of India with religious and social minorities. And, of course, everyone forgets that Modi was not allowed to come to the United States for about 9 years. He was not given a visa because of his involvement in the Gujarat pogrom against Muslims and the anti-Muslim violence that happened there back in 2002 when he was the chief minister of the state. So it's horrible the ways in which Modi has become kind of normalized just because, you know, he runs a country that is a, you know, has a significant market or economic potential.
Hafsa, thank you so much for joining us here on True Talk. I am Samar, Ahmed's co-host. I wanted to ask you about Hindu nationalism. Some people equate it with white supremacy. Are they similar? Is there any difference? Or can you at least talk about this rise in Hindu nationalism?
Yeah, so Hindu nationalism has really always has existed since the 1920s. It was founded on this idea in the late colonial period in India that you know, Hindus are the main race in India, and that India, the entire Indian subcontinent, is a Hindu space, and it's built on a lot of anti-Muslim racism as well. And there are similarities with white supremacy and Hindu nationalists because they both kind of see themselves as the pure or the original inhabitants of the region. There's also an element of the Aryan race that also creeps into Hindu nationalism. What's really frightening, though, is that a lot of Hindu nationalists expressed full support for the Nazi project and what Hitler was doing in Germany and, you know, similarly felt that that's what India should be doing against its religious minorities. So their whole idea is to completely rid this idea that existed of a secular or multicultural pluralistic Indian space. Of course, that idea was always kind of tricky to begin with, but they're really just kind of full on going with that. So anyone who pushes back against this idea of the Hindu Rashtra or the Hindu state is called an anti-national. They're told to go back to Pakistan. So it's a lot of these kind of similar white supremacist views. There's a lot of overlap. But it's troubling in its own way as well.
Also, maybe people assume that they are anti-Muslim only, but I think reading from other Indians writing about them, mm-hmm. they do attack Dalits, Sikhs, Christians who live in India. Is that true?
Yes, absolutely.
So it's not really like they are just targeting Muslims.
No. It's anyone who's not Hindu, essentially, in India. Yeah.
Wow.
Anyone who doesn't buy into the idea of India as a Hindu place. Yeah.
But there are millions and millions of these other people. Do they really seriously think they can ethnically cleanse them? Like, what are they going to do with the Christians or the Sikhs or the Dalits and the Muslims? All of those put together are in the millions.
Yeah, I mean, that's the troubling thing is that they, I mean, I think the idea is that they, with Kashmir, there is certainly more of a settler colonial ethnic cleansing project that's happening. I think with other religious minorities in India, the idea is that they just want them to completely submit to this idea of India as this Hindu majoritarian space. So as long as you can go along with that project and not push back, then it's okay, you're fine. But if you start to assert your own kind of cultural and religious identity, then that's where the problem lies. So, you know, even with Christians, there's actual efforts to convert people who converted from Hinduism to Christianity or other religions to have them convert back to Hinduism. This is like an actual ongoing process that's happening in India. And of course, any kind of interreligious marriages between Hindus and anyone else is really looked down upon as well, because that's affecting the purity of the Hindu race.
Are Muslims, Indian Muslims, unanimous in their thinking of Kashmir? Because I remember many years ago, there were two physicians. One was young and one was older, both from India, both Muslim. And both of them had completely different outlook on Kashmir. Like the young, I think, wanted Kashmir to be part of India. And the older gentleman wanted it, although he's Indian, to go to Pakistan. Is that the case? Like, are people...
I think Indian Muslims are divided, but I think I would say that most of them, of course, sympathize with what Kashmiris have to go through, but they also fear for their own position as citizens of India. So they can't actively, at least in, from their perspective, especially because they're so marginalized and always treated as fifth columnists. I mean, if you are an Indian Muslim... within India, you're almost always just treated as a traitor, that you're that mm-hmm. you must have some kind of sympathies towards Pakistan, or that you must want India to fail. This is the kind of context in which they operate within India. So because of this fear, many of them are not willing to kind of speak up or speak for Kashmiris and their right to self-determination. At the most, they might like disagree or outwardly vocalize what India is doing in Kashmir, but they won't necessarily go as far as to say that, you know, Kashmiris have the right to self-determination. There are some Indian Muslims, of course, who have to prove to be more loyal to the king. We see that in the United States as well, where, you know, they just kind of blindly agree and follow with whatever the state is doing just because they think that that's going to help them get somewhere. But I would say that for the most part, there are these sympathies, but people just aren't able to vocally express themselves. That might be a little bit different in the U.S. with the Indian Muslim diaspora, who has really tried to express their concerns about what's happening in Kashmir.
Does Kashmir have any natural resources or a strategic advantage, or it's really not about that, it's just about self-determination?
Well, for India and Pakistan, it is actually about natural resources because Kashmir supplies water. The rivers actually go through Kashmir that go both into India and Pakistan. And there's a treaty called the Indus Water Treaty that both have signed on to but don't necessarily always follow. So I think water for sure is a big part of this dispute between India and Pakistan. But the problem is that people usually just see this as a conflict or a territorial dispute between India and Pakistan. And what ends up happening is that Kashmiris and what they want and their aspirations and, frankly, their rights to their own resources are completely overlooked. So I think that's how people need to kind of shift from seeing it as just between India and Pakistan to actually seeing this as something where, Kashmiris are the primary stakeholders.
Do you see it escalating into a whole-scale war?
It remains to be seen, to be honest with you. I know that Pakistan, for its part, tried to really aggressively approach this through the diplomatic route. Its army knows that it really doesn't have a chance against India unless things become nuclear, in which case that's even more troubling. So Pakistan has tried to go to the United Nations. When Imran Khan was in the U.S., he really... tried to speak about Kashmiris and their right to self-determination. But it seems that unless there's significant international pressure on India, it's unlikely to see what will happen. I mean, already right now we're facing almost 70 days of the siege with this complete communication crackdown and thousands of people being detained. And there is some international outcry. Media are reporting on it. There's been a number of U.S. congressmen and officials who have spoken out against the human rights violations. There's steps being taken towards perhaps passing a House resolution. But I think that internationally, countries need to be a lot more, and countries need to show that there will be consequences if India continues this.
If you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF. We're speaking to Hafsa Khanjawal. She's an assistant professor in South Asian history at Lafayette College. We're talking about Kashmir. In the United States, have politicians been outspoken about what's happening in Kashmir? Is there any movement on Capitol Hill on the Democrat side, or, you know, are they ignoring this issue?
No, there has been a lot of movement. A lot of the Kashmiri diaspora and other Muslim American groups have been meeting with a lot of their leaders, and in district, but also in the Hill. And there was a briefing, a very successful briefing that occurred last week, and a number of staffers came. Excuse me. So there is, I mean, there's been a number of representatives, Pramila Jayapal, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, even Bernie Sanders, at a speech at ISNA, the Islamic Society of North America. He spoke about Kashmir and what's happening and the right and the importance of a UN resolution to be implemented. So there seems to be some kind of traction, and it's not just necessarily Democratic. There are some Republican senators, I believe, Lindsey Graham, for example, also signed on to a letter to the Indian government or to Secretary Pompeo. So there is some movement, for sure. There's going to be a hearing on October 22nd on human rights in Asia broadly, and Kashmir will be discussed there as well. So it remains to be seen what the outcome of that hearing will be. But it's also important to know that the other side, the pro-Indian lobbies in the U.S., are also very, very active. They also make sure to lobby very hard. They are far more well-resourced than any of the Kashmiri diaspora groups are. So it becomes a bit problematic in that way. But we hope that American lawmakers will kind of see the situation for what it is, instead of, you know, just listening to a side that's been conducting a lot of propaganda on the matter.
What can listeners do more to raise awareness or get involved or help the people in Kashmir?
Yeah, so I volunteer with a group called Stand with Kashmir. It's a Kashmiri diaspora-led group that is seeking an end to the occupation and is fighting for the right to Kashmiri self-determination. And it's been, since August 5th, it's actually become quite active throughout the United States and even internationally. So you can visit the website, standwithkashmir.org, and subscribe to the email listserv and hear about events and things that are happening in your city or your town. And I think, I mean, the number one thing is to raise educational awareness about what's happening. A lot of Americans might not know what's happening in Kashmir. They know that, you know, it's one of the troubled parts of the world, but they might not exactly know what's going on. So to do that, to kind of make sure that your media and your elected officials know about the issue and that they're raising it across their platforms, I think is really important. That's the only thing that's gotten us this far right now, where the Indian government is kind of on the defensive because there has been an international outcry. So that really needs to continue.
Red for Kashmir is also a hashtag that's trending.
Yes, it's hashtag Red for Kashmir and hashtag Stand with Kashmir. Both are the trending hashtags. Yep.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. And you can visit standwithkashmir.org to learn more and to get involved with the organization. You can also stay informed. So thank you so much for joining us, Hafsa.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay. When we come back, we're going to be speaking about what's happening between Turkey and northeast Syria and the incursion there and, I guess, the outrage and what Summer has to say. But first, I'm going to play this song and we'll be right back.
Hey, zalima, be vicdan, ne bekleyin. من بفيني وأزراهي لهاد سرمان جرحي من بستيني وأزراهي لهاد سرمان جرحي من بستيني فانك خملا جران ليل بلا شابين ببينه فانك خملا جران ليل بلا شابين ببينه فانك خملا جران ليل بلا شابين ببينه
Welcome back to Truth Talk on WMNF 88.5. That's a...
Did you pick that?
Yeah, I picked it. It's a...
You're good.
It's a Kurdish song, a Kurdish-Turkish song, I guess. He's a Kurdish singer from Turkey.
Do you know the name? Is it... do you know?
It's a love song.
Oh, okay. Ahmed, I want to thank our listeners for contributing last week to True Talk and remind them that they can still support WMNF by going to the tip jar, wmnf.org, and click on the tip jar. And it would be lovely if they send us a few dollars here while True Talk is still on the air. You were just listening to Professor Hafsa talking about the issue of Kashmir. Of course, we should revisit the issue several times. It's a little bit complex and historical and has too many different points of views, as we have seen. But it would be lovely if we can get a few couple of hundred dollars while we're still on the air. I think we have 20 minutes to go.
Are you going to fundraise again?
No, just soft.
Soft?
Soft.
Soft ask.
Soft pitching.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, soft pitching
Cam,
works.
I was listening while driving up here, and
yes.
Cam got, during his music show, a couple of donations, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe 5 of them. So it would be lovely if Ahmed and I can raise a few extra dollars for WMNF. And maybe start having a new budget for cameras and stuff like that. To be seen on the studio. I know Ahmed is transmitting live on Facebook, and there is this thing about sharing, and I did, and I have people from all over the world now, from Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
Some are sharing is caring.
Sharing is caring, and they are looking at us at the moment and seeing. That's why you're so polite today. You're not interrupting me. You're
This is my norm. I'm a gentleman. Summer, I want to talk about something that's serious. It's all over the news. We just heard about it. You know, this is an NPR station or affiliate, so every hour at the top of the hour, right after our show, is going to be NPR News, and they keep talking from NPR to CNN to all the networks about Turkey's military action in northeast Syria and how they're about to massacre our allies, the Kurds. And some of the information out there is I guess misinformation, because a lot of this has, you have to like all conflicts, just like the Kashmir issue we talked about in the past half hour, there's historical context. And you know what it all goes back to the British and these European colonizers, how they colonized and occupied these lands, and when they left, they made a huge mess. Probably on purpose.
Yeah, of course, to make sure that there will always be hot spots, and that, like, imagine if they left India and Pakistan without the Kashmir problem.
Right.
They would not be wasting so much energy on it.
They carved out the Middle East and much of Asia, these arbitrary boundaries and new borders, and created nation states that did not exist before, dividing even tribes and families from each other because of a border. And all of a sudden, now you're Iraqi and now you're Syrian and,
Jordanian.
And these countries did not necessarily exist. They were, in a way, they were autonomous areas under kind of a federal Ottoman rule that allowed local governors to run, you know, things how they wanted to. But then they created these nation states and did not let the people choose their leaders. They installed people who were pro-British, the families that were their allies. The one group that they always promised, a couple of groups, you know, in Israel and Palestine, which is a different story, they promised both sides different things and lied to both sides. And then when it came to the Kurds, there's a group of people called, they're ethnic Kurds. They're called Kurdish. They have their own language, their own culture.
They're not Arab.
They're not Arab, and they're not Turkish or Turkic. They're Kurdish. And in, I guess, Islamic history, the Kurdish people are known to be honorable people, and they're well-regarded because one of their leaders, Salah ad-Din al-Ayyubi, liberated Palestine or the Jerusalem. Holy Land, Jerusalem, from the Crusaders. So they have a very high status. Now, their community is basically what is are now spread across Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the Kurdish community in Turkey accounts for something like 18% within Turkey. 18% of Turkish citizens are Kurdish. It's something like 15 million people. So for people to say, well, you know, that the Turkey wants to eliminate and eradicate Kurds, no, they would start with the people within their own country. So I oppose what's being said in the media. I think it's a wave of misinformation about what's happening there, that somehow Turkey is going to create some sort of genocide within Syria. But then I see it as a double standard, you know, where... Where was this outrage when al-Assad was killing hundreds of thousands of Syrians? This rush to, you know, pass, you know, legislation and to have emergency security. I mean, the activity started on Wednesday, and within like the next day, they had a security UN Security Council meeting, emergency meeting, and in Washington, they already passed, or they didn't pass. They introduced Lindsey Graham. And Chris Van Hollen introduced legislation to sanction Turkey immediately. Immediate action. Some sort of paranoia that we didn't hear when Assad was doing it. So why the double standards, I
or,
ask myself.
Or the poor Yemenis and the war
the
that
Yemenis.
Has been raging on for a while. I will disagree with you on many points, but really there is this interesting article in Forbes magazine. It's by Melek Kaylan. K-A-Y-L-A-N, and he does not like Erdogan, and he mentions that he abhors him, actually.
Yeah, so that's going to drive his opinion.
No,
obviously.
But he says some hard truths about Turkey's invasion of the Syrian Kurds. Like, he establishes that he doesn't like Erdogan whatsoever, but he is doing his utmost to, like you said,
to be balanced
and to talk about these groups that he is fighting. One of them he labels as a terrorist group. So yes, he doesn't like Erdogan. He feels that he is kind of busying his own army, because if there is ever a coup in Turkey, it's usually held by the army and done by the army. So he is being really, after reading it, it really, from somebody who is from that part of the world and does not like the authoritarian system of Erdogan, he is trying to be a bit honest and give a background on what is going on. But the idea where I differ with you, Ahmed, is, for instance, in my local newspaper, they didn't say invasion.
Mm-hmm.
They say it's something like entering,
yeah.
You know, as if you enter the bathroom.
It's an incursion, yeah.
They didn't even say incursion. Activity in Syria.
You think it was
as
watered
if,
down?
As if Canada can just move in to the U.S. with its army and we can call it, oh, Canadians are having an activity in North America.
A picnic?
So my objection really is to the idea of nation states invading other nation states for whatever reason. Because if I approve that, then I have to approve the Saudi incursion into
Yemen. Difference.
Or Egypt bombing Libya, or us going all the way to Iraq and destroying it. And the other thing that you mentioned, yeah, people don't talk about the British. We're not talking about what Bush Jr. did in Iraq and how he destroyed the nation and destroyed the modern Middle East. Like, everything we are seeing now and the idea of Daesh and ISIS and all that, that happened because he destroyed the country of Iraq.
But what does that have to do with what Turkey is doing?
Because
they're going to do the same thing?
We should not approve of violating international law.
Of course. No, we're not approving
it.
Here's the thing, Summer. If you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF 88.5. Summer and I are discussing what's happening in Turkey and in northeast Syria. She wants to call it an invasion. And I don't think it's an invasion. The difference, main difference is, since the civil war has started within Syria, the borders of Syria have not been solid. They're not protected. People are going in and out. There are so many countries that are operating there now, including Russia, Iran, the United States. So many countries have troops within Syria. And because of this political vacuum, of course, many of them were there so they can fight ISIS, which, you know, we don't want to go back to the history that, you know, a lot of this was caused because of the destabilization of the Iraq war. However, as the United States was looking to get in, you know, when Bashar al-Assad was killing so many Syrians, the United States did not act. And even though President Obama had said that, you know, he's drawing a red line at, you know, chemical weapons, he did not act and he hesitated. And that allowed Bashar al-Assad to kill more people. And that also allowed a political vacuum to exist where ISIS, which is basically Al-Qaeda rebranded, was able to exploit and gain grounds there because of that inaction. And it turned into this violent civil war that existed there. The United States was looking. Then the United States decided, well, we need to act because ISIS or this Daesh has become such a huge risk. Let's go in and eliminate them. And as they decided to go in, but they said, well, we're not going to commit ground troops. Who can we work with within Syria to have ground troops? There was something called the Free Syria Army. Mm-hmm. The Free Syria Army are made up of real Syrians who defected from the Syrian army and now were part of the revolution. The United States and Congress...
It went through stages.
Well, it went through stages, but at the beginning...
None of the ones who were really real Syrian defectors remain in that leadership. But the Gulf region came with its money.
You're jumping ahead. I'm talking about what happened at the beginning. Because of this inaction of the United States, it allowed so many people to interfere and to get involved. But the United States, by the time they decided to act, it was too late. The things on the ground had shifted. And instead of supporting the real rebels there, they said the only safe group that will support or ally with as ground troops is something called the Kurdish militants. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to play to you just a short tape here that's 2 minutes of the commander on the ground, the U.S. military commander of SOCOM, which is a Southern Command commander, Raymond Thomas. SOCOM is right here in Tampa at MacDill Air Force Base, describing when they decided to ally with the Kurds, Kurdish militias within Syria as their allies, and they went to them and said, well, we have a problem. And the problem is you guys are the YPG and PKK, which are considered terrorist organizations. PKK is not
in
only
US,
considered, it's even in the U.S. Mm-hmm. It's against U.S. law to ally with the PKK or give them weapons because they're on the designated list of terrorist organizations. The PKK was responsible for killing something like 30,000 people over 2 decades or 3 decades within Turkey. So they're on the list of terrorist organizations. How can the U.S. work with groups like this? So this is the commander. He was speaking at the Aspen Institute in 2017, describing how they overcame this PKK-YPG problem. Here he is.
Is this a good example of how SOCOM identifies the enablers on the ground? And talk us through that process, how you select who you think you can really support and work with.
As you know, sometimes it's of necessity, who's available. The one that I think is most discussed and most misunderstood is the evolution with our counterpart in Syria, the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces. Now, interestingly, they came about that name because at one point in time, and I dealt with them directly, I was in on the formative stage of the relationship with these guys, they formally called themselves the YPG, who the Turks would say equated to the PKK, you're dealing with a terrorist enemy of mine, how can you do that ally? So we literally played back to them, hey, you got to change your brand. You know, what do you want to call yourself besides the YPG? And with about a day's notice, they declared that they were the Syrian Democratic Forces. I thought it was a stroke of brilliance to put democracy in there somewhere. But it gave them a little bit of credibility. And the interesting part, and I was lucky to have a great partner in Brett McGurk out there with me about the same time, because they were asking for things that I couldn't give them. And it literally was an acknowledgement that they were the demographic dominant force in northern Syria. They wanted a seat at the table, whether it's at Geneva or a...
That was the short video clip of the U.S. commander that went and basically worked with the Kurdish. And it's amazing. He basically says that you guys have this problem because you need to change your name. And overnight, they changed your name from YPG and PKK to Syrian Democratic Forces. And basically, you hear the people laughing when he says, I like that they threw in democracy in there somewhere. Because again, this is who they are. They're far left. You can look it up on even, you know, whatever reference you use. PKK is a far left, militant, terrorist organization. That's who the U.S. allied with there, not the regular Syrian Kurds. Now, during that time, as the U.S. was using their air power to drive ISIS out, who was taking over the land? The areas that ISIS had was the SDF or the PKK groups, YPG, these militants. It wasn't land that belonged to them to begin with, and now they're ruling over a majority Arab population that didn't recognize them, but because they had the support of the firepower of the United States, they controlled almost, you know, a quarter or a third of Syria. Turkey says that's unacceptable to us. We can't have YPG, PKK terrorists that have killed so many Turks in the past. We're going to create something called, they're calling it the Peace Corridor, or a free zone, 30 kilometers from the Turkish border all the way within into Syria, that will be free of these groups. And they'll use that, they'll start using that to resettle the millions of Syrian refugees who fled the fighting, who already came from those lands and are now, there are 3 million of them in within Turkey. The ones that want to go back, they'll relocate them back to Syria, to those areas. And to restore basically Syrian rule over those areas. So I think that's what they're trying to do. I think their hands are kind of tied, because if their YPG has all this firepower and the United States gave them all types of weapons to use against ISIS, now who are they going to use those weapons against in the future? So I think they see it as a threat. Seems like a necessary evil. I don't like any type of war or violence, but you know, they do have a point here. The Turks do.
I want to thank Jennifer Rogers from Sand Beach. He gave all of WMNF $150. Thank you so much, Jennifer. You can all go to WMNF.org, click on the tip jar, and you can also mention True Talk.
You're still trying to get money.
Yeah, the money.
You're such a loyal WMNF.
Yeah, I am, I guess so.
Okay, well, so what do you have to say about what I said?
In a minute.
Yes.
We have a minute. Ahmed, as I said, I do not like... On principle, I really don't like the idea of countries invading other countries.
We agree
because
on that.
At the end of the day, it will complicate matters.
I agree. Okay. In principle, I agree.
Yeah. But people really need to Google these things. Like you said, it's so simple. I had a disagreement with you last night. You sent me a bunch of articles.
You kept an open mind.
I kept an open mind, although principally I am 100% against the invasion. I don't believe in it, and I still don't believe in it, and I will never believe in it.
But this invasion started years ago now. Okay. I mean, it's not like Turkey started an invasion.
Whatever.
They're trying to clean up what happened.
Okay, but for instance, like people who said, we still, 21st century?
Yeah.
I'm not sure which year. 2019, and there are still people who send text messages like this, and I'm going to quote it and read it.
Okay.
Well, what do you know about that? Hindus don't like anybody who's not a Hindu, just like Muslims don't like anybody who's an infidel. But I guess that's okay for Muslims to kill infidels, but not for Hindus to kill Muslims. Muslims, right? For God's sake, why don't you just go to the American dictionary and Google infidel? Okay, and think and ask a smart question. I know maybe you do not have all these brain cells to ask a smart question, but Ahmed, the Muslims had an empire, okay, and dominated the modern world
for hundreds of years,
600 years. Why on earth they didn't kill all the infidels? Mm. Why do we have Christianity? Why do we have Judaism?
Churches are still there.
Yeah, like, so people just are, I think, blinded with hate and they can't Google anything anymore. I mean, if we didn't have Google, I would say yes, but anyways.
Summer, we're out of time.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
So I'll see you next Friday, same time, same place.
Best of luck with Muhammad Assaf.
I hope you're going to be there.
No.
No?
No.
You have other plans.
Too many driving.
Too much driving.
Too much driving.
Okay, well, I'll see you next Friday, same time, same place on WMNF. This is True Talk on WMNF, and NPR News is next. Have a great weekend, folks, and stay safe out there. Take care.